We're going to talk guitars and islands today with Bob Brosman. Bob is a fan of big, shiny National Steel guitars, and he's played them all over the world, particularly with other guitarists and particularly in island cultures. We'll explore guitar sounds with Bob today. To start, I ask him how he got started with music.
As a young child, the first music I ever heard that really gave me this ongoing sense of liberty and freedom in music was blues from Mississippi. And what was appealing to me about it, first of all, was the fact that it was improvised music, which means living 1 second in the future when you're improvising. And I really like that. I'm 52 and I'm really fit. The other interesting thing that started me on a journey was the thing called open tunings. And as it turns out, I'm going to kind of work backwards here, but as the European guitar traveled with colonialism, what they call standard tuning should be called crazy tuning, because when you strum the strings open, it sounds like this. Not a beautiful chord. As it turns out, not just in Mississippi, but in Hawaii, in Cuba, in Africa, in the Philippines, in India, in Papua New Guinea, even in Brazil, the least number of turns of the least number of tuning pegs gets you to here, which is like suddenly a very pleasant sound. And, you know, if you're a child confronted with a guitar without instructions, or if you're a native from somewhere confronted with a guitar without instructions, you want music right now. You don't want to have all this stuff to memorize. And like so many European traditions, it's like, no, you have to memorize all this stuff, then you get to have fun. And it's this way because we say it so. Whereas the thing about open tuning is this way is up, and this way is down. What I love about it is the flexibility. I mean, I started out, as I said, loving blues, you know. And then from there, discovered, you know, a little bit of Hawaiian music. It's a short leap to Mexican music. And from there, it's a very short leap to African music. Even sort of North African Arabic music. With this simple idea, it's just given me a complete sense of anarchy, freedom, and real joy of music. And that's 46 years now I've been playing.
So the open tuning is key, but the other thing about these Nationals is they're loud.
Well, they're loud, but more interestingly than that, I mean, an electric guitar is loud too. It's louder, but it's all about the dynamic range. So for me, we live in a world of really compressed music, which, and for the non-techies out there, a compressor is a device that takes the quiet things and makes them louder, and takes the loud things and makes them quieter, and squishes everything down. And I find that a lot of pop music today is not only sonically compressed, it's emotionally compressed, too. There's like nothing going on. There's no texture to bite into. So if you take an ordinary wooden acoustic guitar or an electric solid body guitar, the difference between your softest touch and your hardest hit is not very big. On this instrument, I have all the possibility to play very sweet and quiet. But when I need some aggression, it's a lovely hip-hop machine. These were invented in the 1920s, before the electric guitar, and the body's made of metal. I've got a full drum kit in here, so I've got, you know, so I'd like to incorporate that as I play in certain kinds of stuff. I'm not a Luddite. I'd only believe in good music and bad music. And so, you know, every rhythm attracts me. Every style of music attracts me. And everybody should just dig in and find the 10% that they really like the best.
You present a really interesting point in some of the things that I've seen you write about how colonialism actually brought this instrument to all these different places. Why the guitar in particular? Just because of its portability?
That's a large part of it, the portability. And it's an instrument that's easy to get started with, particularly if you avoid European standard tuning and memorization, because you can get everything you want with two strings. You hear this kind of playing in blues music, African, Mexican, Hawaiian, all kinds of music where it's just two strings being used to get all your majors and minors, like this. And so it's just so easy to improvise and make solos and not have to think about scales and memory.
Brosman is our guest on the World Cafe today, and he's playing one of a couple of beautiful national guitars he has with him, and he has a couple of other instruments. I would like to get a little bit of sense about how your this all didn't come to you at once. You didn't all these
oh,
different
no.
cultures did not you didn't discover them all at once. But was Hawaii one of the first places, musical cultures that you got involved with?
What happened was, as a kid, I heard blues. I heard Delta blues, especially Charlie Patton. It just knocked me out. I'd never heard anything so intense, so heartfelt, you know. I mean, it really had a big effect on me. And that open tuning thing of you know, and very simple one chord stuff, that's how I started. From there, I discovered the Hawaiian music. I first heard blues and fell in love with open tunings, and when I discovered that the Hawaiians were using the same instruments,
mm-hmm.
In fact, the guys that built the Nationals in the 20s, they didn't know anything about blues music.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know it existed, even. These guitars were built for Hawaiian players, actually.
And there was a real craze here on the stateside for Hawaiian music, wasn't there?
Absolutely. 1916 was a year where more Hawaiian records were sold than any other kind of records in this country because of, you know, it was the first sort of world music craze, actually.
Exotic, beautiful, yeah. Now, Bob, you've switched instruments.
I have.
Yeah.
So this is sort of the father of the National. This is the first kind of guitar that was laid on the lap to play Hawaiian music. This instrument is played on your lap with a bar. It's like having one finger to play with, and you can't bend it. And the whole style of music developed from it that country music owes a lot to. And there was a lot of borrowing back and forth. I mean,
mm-hmm.
It's fascinating to me how technology affects the spread of music. 110 years ago, there was only one place you could hear music from, a musician. The first revolution in this country was sheet music. Suddenly, you've got people all over the country playing the same songs. That was the first mass media. The next thing that happened was Sears Roebuck mass-produced cheap instruments. That really helped a lot of people play music. And then finally, the phonograph record.
Mm.
And at the very beginning, it was a bit of a random process because there wasn't really A&R. Nobody knew what would sell. So a lot of interesting random stuff got recorded. And so then you have musicians listening to other kinds of music. You've got Hawaiians trying to play blues. You've got blues guys trying to play Hawaiian. You've got both of them listening to Big Spiderbeck. So I actually got led into old vintage jazz through the back door of Hawaiian music.
Hmm.
And from there, I started hearing some stuff from New Orleans and realizing some of those guys were coming up from Trinidad, started listening to Calypso. And from there, it was to African music.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about Hawaiian music, because my understanding is a lot of the players of Hawaiian music closely guard what they do. And correct me if I'm wrong about this, but what has your experience been when you get to a different culture like that and you hear you set up your guitars and say, come on, let's play together?
Well, I think for me... the first order of business is to dispel all of the socioeconomic myths about, oh, here comes some American guy. Now, there are some, you know, as you know, I collaborate with people all over the world. You've probably noticed with all my multiple albums, number one, I put my name second, not first. Number two, you may not know this, but I don't show up with a big entourage. I don't stay in the Hilton. Whoever I'm collaborating with knows from the first note, in the first day, his name's going first. We're splitting the money 50-50, or in Papua New Guinea, we're splitting it 58 ways.
Right.
If I'm making a mistake in this man's music, I want to be told. I don't want anybody to be afraid of me. And the result is, you know, we eat in the same food, we sleep in the same shack, and the result is we get a really good blend of music. Because to me, music is like any other personal relationship. Ideally, you want the other person you're with to be comfortable and happy. So I take very good care of the people I work with. I watch them like a doctor. I watch them like a psychiatrist. I watch them like an anthropologist. I watch them like a friend, and, of course, as a musician. So I find if you enter into any culture with that attitude and you make it clear from the get-go, all doors open. I also try to speak the local languages wherever I go, and you know, you can see I'm a pretty kind of open-minded sort of
fella. Right, right. Well, let's do a for instance. Let's talk about Rene Lakai. Maybe you should talk a little bit about who he is and how that relationship.
Okay, grew. Let's see. Let me work up to that if I can. Let's see. So, in the 1980s, I discovered an old Hawaiian family who made their first records in 1929, made their last record with me in 1989. Wow. 60 years later, after touring the world and traveling everywhere. And that was the first glimpse for me into collaboration. In the mid-90s, I started collaborating with some slack key players, Led Ka'apana, Cyril Pahanui, and that was kind of interesting because slack key is a way of playing Hawaiian guitar, as I was just a minute ago, kind of in the normal guitar position, just picking the melody, and steel is played on the lap. Steel went around the world. Slack key stayed home on the farm in Hawaii until the 70s when there was a resurgence in it. And so I'm proud to say, you know, some of our records are some of the first where we're bringing those two things together. And so to play with those guys, I had to compromise the style to make it a little more like slack key. So a normal Hawaiian piece might be played without the accompaniment. It would be something like this. Because somebody else would be going da 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 da. So to play it together, something like this. Or, you know, the real sweet stuff. Next collaboration I did was Okinawan music with Takashi Hirayasu, and that was a little further afield, but still kind of somewhat familiar. There's a lot of beautiful, you know. And from there, you know, just I learned to.
Well, let's stop in Okinawa for a second, because that seems a lot more percussive, just from what you just played. Mm. And how were instruments, and how was the culture introduced there? Was that through the American war effort, or was it before?
Well, here's the thing. Okinawa is a 600 or 700 year old culture, independent kingdom, and it became a colony of Japan. And actually, Okinawan music was kind of a good confirmation for me of a global theory I have that there's only two kinds of rhythm in the world, the rhythm of colonizers and the rhythm of the colonized. And it's not a black-white issue. Japanese, because colonizer music is on the beat. Colonizers like to march in step. The people who are marched upon see the beat as something you react to.
You found this everywhere, huh?
Everywhere. Wow. And Japan, Japanese music's on the downbeat. Okinawan music's really on the upbeat. It's a lot of this kind of... let's see. Lots of upbeat stuff. Everything in blues happens on an upbeat. Everything in ska is on an upbeat. And so I kind of have formulated a lot of new theories of ethnomusicology through long, slow observation. At any rate, I started falling in love with island music, generally Hawaii, Trinidad, the Caribbean, Okinawa. And so... I started realizing, okay, this is the path I'm going to follow for a while, is island projects. And the director of the festival in Quebec, who I'd worked for many, many times up there, he suggested René Lacaille to me. And serendipity is a big part of my career. I don't ever try to push anything towards me because that's impossible. I just let things happen to me and you know, follow suggestions. And every good project I've done has always started with somebody saying, you know, I think this would be a good idea. And then it materializes. Mm. So just at the same time that the director of the Quebec Festival told me about René Lacaille and gave me his record, I got invited to Reunion Island to play at a blues festival there. And so we met for the first time on stage in front of 2,000 people at an outdoor amphitheater and had a play right there. And the people on Reunion, they do not tolerate anything but real sincere going for it. They're legendary for if you're not really putting out a sincere show, they'll throw things at you. And it was just pandemonium. I mean, you know, for me, I as an American traveling, I feel like I have to go an extra 20 miles to undo some of the rude behavior and political socioeconomic damage that we've caused around the world. Don't mean to offend anybody, but, you know, remember, only 7% of the population of this country has ever been outside of this country. It's if you've got the means to send your children traveling, please do so, because it really opens the mind. At any rate, it was really just like a revelation for me, and I mean, I was just accepted immediately. And Renee's music is not easily apparent right off the bat. It's pretty tricky stuff. And I'd love to explain how it goes.
Sure.
Reunion Island is a place where African rhythm and Indian rhythm met under French colonialism. And so, without going into a long, boring lecture, Africans get all their multiple rhythms by layering rhythms on top of each other. Indians get their rhythm by displacing phrases later in time. And the only area of the world where those two ideas meet is in Reunion.
Oh, my God.
So... where we jaunty Westerners consider a tempo to be something like 1, 2, 3, 4, the basic African tempo for all music is always 2 against 3, which sounds like this. 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. It's both. It's either and it's both. In Reunion, the displacement factor moves that 2 back a half beat, so it's a little shocking. It's like this. 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. And so the loud thing is happening in the unexpected place. To put that on the guitar, a European waltz might sound like this. An African waltz would start to do this. And on Reunion Island, it's one step higher of level of syncopation. So it really challenges one's multitasking. And next time you're at a gig, watch the musician's eyes and check out when their eyes either close or roll up into their head. What's happening there? What's happening is we're all running liquid software programs between our ears. And when the RAM gets full with a musical task, the brain dumps the vision software. And I love that sensation because we're the only computer that can increase its processor speed and power. And so if, as a musician, you bring yourself to software crash, and then the next time you try harder and harder, and Renee's music is the first music that I really experienced that.
Well, it's interesting that on this whole journey that your latest album, you've kind of gone full circle and you've gone back to the South of America, and you have a new blues album called Blues Reflex. How did that take place? How did you decide to do that?
Well, you know, I've made records now for some 30 years, and a lot of my fans really request, you know, they're kind of some... It's funny, you know, I guess a musician's worst nightmare would be to have a hit song and have to do it that way for the rest of your life. And then there are some artists that arrive at fame very early, and then they never change for the rest of their life. And I would think, man, that'd be like being in some sort of prison. So for me, I know there's always a percentage of the fans that want something I was doing 30 years ago. And I thought, you know, this music that first turned me on was blues as a kid. And when I listen to Charlie Patton and Tommy Johnson, it still makes me feel that way. And I've never forgotten that music, and I've played it my whole life, on stage and off stage. You know, to sum up what I'm driven by love of music and curiosity, and I'm looking for that thing that kind of gets you right in the guts. I mean, you know, there's just something about a certain blues sound that just, I've never really lost that feeling in my head. And
here we go, picking up another international.
Really make sure that new string is stretched. Particularly the early blues, before they got to the happy blues. You know, the happy blues is the come on, everybody! You know, it's just a little too happy for me. So. I like a little bit of the darker stuff.
Cypress Grove. I would rather to be buried, oh Lord, in a lonesome cypress grove. Oh, then if you lay around here, mama, body's getting cold. I mean, when your knees are aching and your body's getting cold. Ah, well, you know you're getting ready. Thank you. murder.
Yeah.
Every day. Ooh, seem like murder. Yeah. And I'm leaving in the morning, mama. Well, that's you, never mind. I'm leaving in the morning. Well, I know that you never mind.
Bob Brosman, almost everything we've been talking about coming into playing on that tune. That's thank you so much for coming by today.
Oh, well, it wasn't exactly just stopping by. I flew in from California just for this.
Oh, my gosh. Well, thank you so much for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here, and I appreciate you being interested.
Bob Brosman, our guest, and we shall return in a moment here on the World Cafe. Thanks again to Bob Brosman for joining us today. His latest solo album is called Blues Reflex. Bob Brosman, our guest. If you're looking for those albums, you can find them at our World Cafe CD store, which is at our website at worldcafe.npr.org.